Welcome to Award Leaders. I'm your co-host, John, joined by the English dandy, David. This is our night at the Oscars, where we watch Oscar-winning movies while enjoying Oscar Mayer Wieners. It's a celebration of American culinary and cinematic pop culture. In this episode, we talk about the English period piece, Tom Jones, winner of the 1963 Oscar for Best Picture. Dave, what is going on?
Hello, my good man. I'm doing quite well. How are you doing?
Excellent. Tipping my hat at you, but you can't see that.
I would be a dandy from this time period, now that I think about it. For example, today I use some under-eye things that Sarah bought me. They're pretty nice, John.
That does not even make sense, Dave. Under-eye things.
You put them under your Sarah eye you. When you don't sleep, because I went to bed at midnight and got up at 4:30, and it no
so
helps.
You have bags under your eyes, is what you're saying, and you got these things to help smooth them out.
Yeah, maybe look at least 4 days younger.
That's good. All right, congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We want to look my best today. What's going on with you?
What is going on with me? They haven't sponsored us, so I think I can say this. I think I'm going to give up on MoviePass.
Dude, it's really bad.
It is.
I have a story, actually, about this. I think this is a really good segue.
I keep trying to look to see if there's movies that are playing in my area that I can use the pass for, and I haven't actually been able to really use it in about 2 months. It might be time that I call it quits. I might give it one more month because Oscar season is upon us, but, you know, I don't know.
I have thought about it as well. All the times are really poor and the movie selections aren't that good. Here's my story related to that. I tried to go see A Star is Born for this episode so we could talk about it because it's one of the top three movies so far of the year. By the time I left my apartment and then got to the movie theater, it was no longer available. So I just couldn't see it. I ended up seeing Suspiria instead, which is cool because I like horror and I like Suspiria. We can move into that as well if you want to talk about that. In general, I'm with you. It's really starting to annoy me. I wish they did better. Did you get the email yesterday with the dog?
I might have, but I didn't see it.
So listeners and John, they sent an email out that featured the company's dog mascot. I'm sure it belongs to someone who's in the higher up on the executive board. And it was their director of marketing apologizing for having, you know, had a rough year.
For taking a shit on everything in your entire house and spreading it around?
Look, there's a way to do that that is fun, but they missed the ball completely. It's just bad, bad marketing. I got kind of annoyed about it. I was like, God, guys, like, can't you do anything right? Like, you just fuck up everything.
Yeah. I didn't see that email, but it sounds like the tone like was really not what they needed to do in that moment in time when everyone's pissed off sending out an image of their dog and trying to make light of the situation. Didn't seem to be the right move is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, but there was no situation. There was no like – I mean the situation is their shitty customer service. Sending this email out randomly by all accounts doesn't help. Well, whatever. But I agree with you. I'm on the edge. I'm looking at some other options. We'll see. Keep me posted. Until then, I'm going to soldier through for a little bit longer, maybe.
Cinema's running a sale.
I know. It does look pretty awesome.
I need to look at that, too, just to see what's up.
So speaking of Suspiria, I did see that movie. It is a good but not great film. If you're a fan of the original Suspiria, the 1977 cult classic horror movie, this film is much, much different. So don't go in expecting just a rehash of the first one. I would probably give it a 7, 7.5. So not bad. That's really the only first run movie I've seen in a little bit.
Because of MoviePass.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I want to go see some other films, but again, like, I can't get in.
Yeah. All right. So, Suspiria, what did you think of the cinematography? Because I heard a lot about that in the reviews.
There was a lot of really cool scenes. They do a lot of interesting visuals throughout it. I had to think about it. I initially didn't really like it that much, but then I thought about it and realized that it was pretty cool. I think I confused sort of the color palette with the cinematography when I first saw it, and I don't like the way it looks in terms of color because the first one is so bright and vivid. I think the cinematography was good. The editing was good. Tilda Swinton did a really good job. There are some incredibly, incredibly grotesque scenes. Like, I looked away from the screen at least 3 times, and I usually don't do that. So if you have a weak constitution or you don't like violence, just do not see this movie. Do not go anywhere near it.
All right. So tying that into this movie, how many times do you think you turned yourself away from the screen in Tom Jones?
My smart-ass answer is at least 3 times because I just turned the movie off and went and did something else. But if you're talking about violence – There was one scene, the hunt scene is really where I looked away. That's probably the main one.
Okay. Well, I was thinking more of you looking at your phone during this movie.
Oh, dude. All the time. Throughout the entire thing.
There you go. So we had some feedback. Someone was like, we want to know your opinion of the movies right up front. Bam. You got it. This is going to be two angry dudes telling you about the 2 hours that they wasted of their life.
2 hours? That's it? This is like 4 hours because I had to watch it twice. I looked at my phone the entire time through the first one. So then I was like, I guess I got to watch it again because I don't remember anything.
So, Dave, how would you summarize this masterpiece?
That's a great question that I don't know how to answer. Let me look at my phone. No. Rapscallion Tom Jones meanders through misadventures while trying to win the girl next door's heart.
I think that's pretty good. I think the only thing I would add to that is it's a period piece that's set in the 1700s in England. He's not a lord, doesn't exactly have a title, so he'd probably be known as Esquire, separating him from the common folk, but not quite being someone of the gentry. Sort of in between. So he would probably be Tom Jones Esquire.
He's the middle class of the 1700s.
Esquire is a term in England. It doesn't mean lawyer. That's only in the United States that it means lawyer. I don't know why the U.S. adapted it that way. But in England, it's like not a commoner, not like a full-on royal.
It's like your third cousin or your bastard.
It was used with bastards a lot, actually.
Okay, and that makes sense. So, John.
Red carpet time.
It's red carpet, my favorite time of the episode.
So if you're a first-time listener, you should know that we eat movie-themed hot dogs while watching these movies. Tonight on the red carpet, Dave, how was your hot dog dressed?
So I based my hot dog recipe off a scene in this movie, a pretty well-known scene in which Tom and another lady eat a lot of food in a sexual manner.
Mrs. Waters.
My mother's maiden name, by the way.
That's how your parents met.
Just jamming oysters in their mouth.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Eating the whole pear. All of it.
But that's part of the scene. You're right. She had a pear. So what I did was I caramelized some pears. I put it over my hot dog. I added some gooey, melty goat cheese. It was fine. It wasn't great. Really not one of my best creations. Sort of like this film. Meh.
That does not sound appealing to me.
Well, it's not that great. That's why this is one, guys, you could skip. John, what do you have?
I'm going to call this a Tom Jones dog. So the movie takes place in the countryside on a farm. I was actually out on a farm last week, and I bought some hot dogs made on the farm. So I guess they were a little less processed, a little more local. I made a mistake when I first got them home. They were like frozen solid, so I figured I'd speed the process up and boil two of them. Don't do that. It ruined the taste. Definitely just cook them in a pan if you get like those natural sausages. Lesson learned.
Yeah, we had some stinkers this week. Sorry.
Yeah.
So what we do in every episode is that I like to talk about some food facts just related to the movie or the time period. And John, what I wanted to talk about this time is really foods that people say, or some studies, quote unquote, say help with sex. And that's because this is what critics call a body film, meaning that there's just a bunch of sex antics in it.
Sure.
I want you to, off the top of your head, let me know or tell me, are there any foods that you think help with sex lives?
Hot dogs.
Hot dogs? You see like a dude or a man eating a hot dog salaciously, that's hot?
It's a wiener in a bun.
Oh yeah, you're right. Ugh.
And they're usually hot dogs. They're hot wieners in buns.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's no science on it that I know of, but, you know, I'll accept it. This is a hot dog movie podcast. Other than that, do you want to take a guess at what some of these might be?
So aphrodisiacs.
Aphrodisiacs. More, sort of. They're not entirely aphrodisiacs, but yeah. That's
aphrodisiac food.
Yes.
Okay. So I think I know some of the answers. It's oysters, I'm pretty sure, is one.
Yep.
So I've seen this list like years ago, but I can't remember. There's like some really weird things on there. I know there's some kind of fruit on there, and I don't remember which fruit it is. It's like, what's the fruit with a lot of little seeds inside of it that you kind of...
Pomegranate?
Pomegranate?
It's on there. Yeah, it's on there.
Is it? Okay. I knew that because it's supposed to represent a fruitful womb, so apparently eating pomegranate will help with fertility. What else helps with fertility? Dang, I feel like there are things that men are supposed to eat for virility, and I don't remember what they are. It's probably like frog or something weird like that.
Okay, so I'm going to run you through what I have, and I'll also say what the food is supposed to do. So you got one, oysters, definitely.
Okay.
They are high in zinc, and that can boost semen production and regulate sex hormones. Chocolate is one that's supposed to boost serotonin levels, and serotonin is basically like the you know, feel good drug.
I should have known that one. That one seemed obvious.
Yeah, yeah. How about asparagus? It's high in vitamin E, which is involved in stimulating the production of sex hormones as well.
It also makes your pee smell.
Yes.
Women love that.
Ugh. Chilies, they increase blood flow. So that's sort of tangential there.
I'm not rubbing chilies on my willy, Dave.
Oh, chili. Good callback. Watermelon's supposed to relax blood vessels, so make it easier. And I don't know how to pronounce this, but this is a root vegetable. It's M-A-C-A, maca?
Sure.
Yeah, it's supposed to increase stamina and heighten awareness.
It sounds like cocaine, Dave.
Just let's do some cocaine and bang. This is my favorite, my absolute favorite of this list I found. Celery.
Okay.
It has phytoandrogens in it. I'm sure I butchered that. And that is supposed to be something that's similar to testosterone, and it can increase sexual desire in women. And let me tell you, John, nothing is sexier than when a woman eats an ant on a log.
I like those, I have to say.
What type? I think there's two types of ants on a log.
Peanut butter, crunchy peanut butter, personally crunchy peanut butter, and raisins.
Okay. What about cream cheese and raisins?
Is that so-called ants on a log? I have not tried cream cheese in celery. Guess it's probably not too far off from like a ranch dressing, kind of. But I have not done that. That doesn't actually sound good to me.
I prefer peanut butter. So yeah, I'm with you on that one. Finally, I have one more, and that's bananas. They are high in potassium, which helps you have muscle strength and in theory intensifies orgasms.
I was going to say banana. It looks really phallic. But then I was like, that's too obvious.
So some of these are sort of, I would say, oh, it increases blood flow, and then, you know, that should, in theory, help. So just keep that in mind. And next time you go out, remember, get your lady some ants on a log.
I will do that.
Fine diet. I'm just imagining.
Hey, baby, you want to come over and eat some ants on a log?
He's like, no.
Take a nap after recess?
Want to play dodgeball?
Have any orange slices to go with that?
Okay, let's move on to the next section.
All right, movie facts. So this movie was released September 29th, 1963. The runtime is a lengthy 128 minutes. The budget was $1 million, and the box office haul was $37.6 million.
It was a simpler time there, John. Much simpler time.
Huge, huge return.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It was directed by Tony Richardson, and I'll get into who he was in a minute. This film was nominated for 10 awards and won 4, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Original Score. It went up against Cleopatra, How the West Was Won, America, America, and Lilies of the Field. Dave, have you seen any of those movies?
The only one I've seen is Cleopatra, which I finished this morning, actually. I had seen it off and on in my youth, but I had never...
It's a four-hour movie.
Yeah, it took me 3 days to get through it.
Yeah.
I generally really like it. I'm surprised that it holds a 56% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
So the acting isn't always great. Elizabeth Taylor really isn't that great of an actress, but the movie's a lot of fun. And the same guy who wrote All About Eve wrote this film and directed it. So I thought the dialogue was really actually pretty sharp frequently, even though it goes by really fast. I find Roman history at that time to be really interesting also, and I think it was semi-historically accurate.
I think I agree with you on all those things. I'm really glad I've watched the miniseries Rome, so I understood a little bit more about what was going on.
I also saw the movie How the West Was Won. I watched that. That's like another three-hour American Western that has a whole bunch of stars in it. John Wayne, James Stewart, and others. Not the best movie. Some of it looks great. It was filmed in this like Cinerama view. So even on a widescreen TV, it's still very, very thin because the aspect ratio is something crazy. It has weird effects sometimes, like the edges of the screen kind of bend a little bit because they're using such a wide lens. It looks kind of funky. But the colors really pop because they oversaturated a lot of them and overdeveloped some of the film. But it looks good, especially in those Western scenes. And I did not see Lilies of the Field, which I also heard was really good. I think Sidney Poitier won Best Actor for that film. But I did not get to it. And I don't even know what America is about.
Meh, we saw the main ones.
We'll talk about which one we think should have won at the end of all this. This movie was based on the 1749 book, The History of Tom Jones, A Foundling, by Henry Fielding. So Dave, do you know what a foundling is?
I haven't looked it up, but I'm going to guess it's like a child that's been left in a location, like an orphan.
Yeah, that's exactly it, like on a doorstep kind of thing.
Okay.
And it was pretty common, I guess, at the time. There's even a story here in Washington, D.C., someone left a baby on the stairs of the Smithsonian.
Wow.
At the castle. They just turned it over to the local orphanage. So it's not like foundlings, like it's better for foundlings to leave them on a doorstep somewhere. Just take them right to the orphanage. We'll just save everyone some time. And this book was 18 separate books, totaling over 1,000 pages when it was originally released. So it was released kind of episodically. It is considered one of the first British novels and was very salacious at the time, so much so that the Bishop of London blamed the book for 2 earthquakes.
Oh, you reading that dirty book? Earthquakes are coming.
Yeah, it was the 50 Shades of Grey of its day.
I haven't read it, but based on the movie, ugh.
It's only 1,000 pages, Dave. What were you doing this last week?
So many other things that were better with my time, one of which was watching Cleopatra.
So the writer and director, that was Tony Richardson, and I don't remember the name of the writer, approached an irreverent novel the only way they felt they could, irreverently, which kind of comes through in the film, I think.
Can I ask a question about that? Mm-hmm. A little bit of a smart-ass question. Does that just mean they did whatever the hell they wanted?
I think they just didn't take it too seriously, because Tom Jones as a character doesn't take himself very seriously and is kind of always fooling around in a way, like literally and, you know, less literally.
Yeah. And what's an example of them being
irreverent?
Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
They break the third wall a lot. There's a lot of moments where it's like, there's like a sex scene and then they'll say something jokingly like, well, you know, due to good taste and we know that you're an upstanding young person or whatever watching this film, we're not going to show you like this nastiness that's about to happen. Or they speed up the film time a bit as not to be very seriously. So like when there's a chase scene, when people are running around chasing each other, they speed it up. So it's kind of like
Yakety sax.
Yeah, something like that basically. They're like speeding it up and they add like funny music and things like that. I think there's some really great funny scenes in the film. Like the narrator, I think, helps advance some of that. But we'll get into that in a minute. The writer who adapted this movie condensed the story greatly, right? So we had 1,000 pages and they had 2 hours to show the film. Director Tony Richardson did not like the script very much and rewrote much of it himself because the writer declined to make any more edits.
That's such a baller move.
He's like, I'm sure he was like, "That fuck, that dude's fired." But it did win an Oscar for a Best Adapted Screenplay, because I guess it was a giant epic that they condensed. So Tony Richardson himself won 2 Oscars, both for this film, writing and directing. He was one of the more experimental indie filmmakers of his time, and he was considered part of the British New Wave of Cinema, also known as the Grime Up North, as it was filmed outside of London studios and was in a much more working-class part of England. Stylistically, New Wave cinema is usually black and white, shot with a lot of handheld cameras. It was the antithesis to overly produced Hollywood films. So most of the movies are done on location with real people instead of having extras to capture the real feel. And this is known as cinema verite. Tom Jones kind of stands out in this genre because it actually was a studio-backed film done in this style. And it was done in color. And it was a period piece, which none of the other New Wave films are really that, because they're all more realistic in that sense. They just want to show you how life really is, not doctored for film. This was a mishmash of these two genres. What was also interesting about his film choices, so it's a 1740s period piece that was done with modern filming techniques. So again, when I talked about them speeding up those chase scenes or having them break the fourth wall and look at the camera and say something, you know, that really broke the rules for genre films too. So it did a lot of things irreverently, we can say, or just sort of out of
character.
It's iconoclastic.
Okay, I get it.
And the director was dealing with severe depression during this film because I think that was part of his nature. And also he thought the film was going to be a total flop that was going to ruin him. His depression resulted in the hurried ending. The end of the film moves a lot faster. They go through a lot more in like 20 minutes and like wrap the damn thing up. That's because he was butting up against some time constraints and they ran out of money. Kind of a random side note about Tony Richardson. He was bisexual and he died of complications from AIDS in 1991. And I wonder if, you know, him struggling with his identity in a time where he couldn't really talk about it in the 60s led to some of his depression.
I'm sure it did.
Then I'm going to try to speed through some of these actors because they're not really known for too much outside of this film. Except maybe the first two. So we have Albert Finney. He was nominated for Best Actor. He plays Tom Jones. He's been nominated for Best Actor 4 times in total, but has never won. He's probably best known for his role in Annie as Daddy Warbucks. So he's the bald guy in the movie Annie. He was in the movie Scrooge, Skyfall, and several Bourne films also. He's also been in a bunch of British TV shows you've probably never heard of, and he did not like working on this movie at all.
That's surprising. He looks like he had a good time on the reel. Like he had a fun character.
Well, he said the character was very one-dimensional, and he is. And they didn't develop him out enough. And he just felt like he was doing the same thing over and over and wasn't really allowed to like overly emote or act much at all.
You mean smirk and be like, I guess I'm going to have sex with this woman now.
Yep, pretty much. The other actor in this movie that's kind of well known is Hugh Griffith. He was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. He won Best Supporting Actor, not for this role, but for his role in Ben-Hur as the chariot trainer. And you can check out our Ben-Hur episode. I think that's our first episode, actually.
It is our first episode. Uno.
So maybe don't check that out. That was, we've come a long way.
Real quick on Ben-Hur. It's long and we mostly liked it.
Back to your Or 31.
Was it 31 or 41?
I don't know. It's been a long time since we watched that movie. And then three cast members were nominated for Best Supporting Actress. And this is the only movie to have ever done this. Their names are, oh man, I'm going to butcher these names. Dan Cilento. And this is the role she's best known for. I think she was our main lady.
Sophie?
I think she was Sophie. I could be wrong.
It was Molly, Sophie, and then Bridget.
Yeah, so she's known for marrying and divorcing Sean Connery and didn't really act much after that. So unfortunately, that's all she's known for. There's Edith Evans, who's nominated for 3 Oscars, but also never won. And then there's Joyce Redman. She was also nominated for her role in the best winning picture movie, Othello, opposite of Laurence Olivier. So we will probably talk about her again, but none of them won. So this movie ties the record for most acting nominations, 5, without a win, with another movie called Peyton Place, which I don't know anything about.
It's a sad record to have.
Yeah. It's like you failed 5 times. At once. But not really. It's you're the worst of the best.
Worst of the best?
You were nominated for the best film of the year, best actress, best actor, but you didn't win. You're the worst of the best.
Okay. So do you want me to do the movie summary, John?
Dave, I would love for you to do the movie summary.
All right. Are you ready? Because I'm going to psych myself up for this. Oof. All right. Think Tom Jones. Think about Tom Jones. Think about Ants on a Log. You got this.
It's not unusual.
It's not unusual.
To be loved by anyone.
To hate so much.
Yeah.
All right. So the film opens with a silent scene, which catches us up on the backseat of our main character, Tom Jones. We're in an English manor in the countryside. The year is 1749, and we are introduced to Squire Allworthy. He's a well-to-do gentleman. Squire Allworthy comes home after a long trip to discover a child in his bed, and that child is a foundling. So who does this child belong to? This child belongs to Jenny Jones and a man named Partridge, and both of them work at the manor. The scandal here is that they aren't married.
What?
Yeah, I know. Can you believe that? Ooh. Allworthy dismisses both Partridge and Jenny. He names the child Tom Jones and decides to raise him as his own. Nonetheless, Tom is completely stigmatized because he is a quote-unquote bastard. So, John, at this point, very beginning, first scene, what were you thinking?
This gets back to the irreverence that they treated the subject matter with. It was kind of fun. So it was silent, and they used title cards for the characters. It was in color, though, which I feel like they could have made it black and white because it would have been the flashback scene. They kind of missed the mark there on that joke. But it's kind of a zany sequence where we see Squire Allworthy go into his bedroom. He goes into this closet in one door, comes out the other door 1 second later from street clothes to pajamas in like 3 seconds. And there's a lot of little gags like that. It's kind of fun, honestly. And it moves along pretty quickly. And they catch you up on Tom and who he is and where he comes from.
Yeah, so at this point, I was pretty excited, honestly. I was like, I thought the first part, 10 minutes, maybe not even that. Mm-hmm. It zipped along. It was funny. I was really digging it. There was that strange music in the background that was upbeat. I was like, yeah, finally, I'm going to get a really good comedy out of these Best Picture winners.
And then what happened, Dave?
And then the drudgery started.
Just
more and more of it piled on. So in the next scene, we skip ahead in time. And Tom, who's played by Albert Finney, has grown up into a likable, handsome rascal. Do you want to describe him for us?
So Tom is exactly that. He's well-intentioned, kind, and well-liked. And he's well-liked by everybody, too. So he's kind of accepted in both worlds, the sword of the gentry, because he participates with his adopted father and also with the working class, because the working class knows him as a bastard and thinks that he's one of them. He also has no impulse control at all. So he bangs every woman he comes across, and comes across every woman he bangs. But he's never a creep. It's never like he's advancing upon any of these women forcefully. They always advance on him. So I think that's kind of one thing to note too. He's just generous with his love. Any woman who wants to love him, he's willing to love them back. Basically what it is.
Keeps stumbling into all these beds.
He keeps getting invited and he never says no. And then I think the other thing of note here too is that at the time, having a person live in these two worlds of the upper class and the working class wouldn't have happened. So this was a really interesting book to have someone be able to do that. That's probably in part why it was popular at the time. It appealed to two different audiences. This was something like radically different.
It doesn't come across very well in the film though. Like if you think about it, sure, but they don't like explicitly say that, do they?
We're probably missing a lot in here. I feel like there's another film you and I watched that was like this where you're not British and I'm not British, so we don't understand all these little British societal rules.
That's a good point. Yeah, I don't get any of it.
Me either.
All right.
I'm just like, pardon me, sir. Would you pass the Grey Poupon?
Grey Poupon's probably not even made in England.
I don't know, but you can put it on a hot dog.
All right, so in the next scene, Tom goes hunting. And while he's hunting, or getting ready to go hunting, he comes across Molly Seagram. Molly.
Yeah, he does.
Molly seduces Tom because she thinks it will be to her advantage.
It shall be our custom to leave such scenes where taste, decorum, and the censor dictate. In this way, we shall try to make up for our incorrigible hero.
This is an example of some of like the good dialogue, and she's making a lot of innuendos like, oh, you're out hunting, huh? And implying that she's the game.
Yeah, and then she's like, hey, Tom, can I get a job? That's what she basically says after this is over.
In the next scene, we meet Blifil. I hate this name, by the way. It's really hard to say. It's Blifil. And this is Blifil.
Okay.
It's Squire Allworthy's nephew, and he dislikes Tom because Tom is everything Blifil is not. Tom is attractive, he's funny, he's well-liked, and he also stands to inherit much of his uncle's wealth.
So side note, the guy who plays Blifil is David Warner. He was a regular in the Star Trek movies and TV shows, so he played a lot of these extra characters. I know he was a Cardassian in a bunch of episodes.
Oh, do you not know like the name or...
Not one of the big ones in like Deep Space Nine. He was in Next Generation and then some of the earlier movies with the original Star Trek cast.
Oh, got it. Okay. So after Tom has his tryst with Molly, he does end up eventually at the neighboring manor and he's there to visit the Westerns. While he's there, we meet Sophie Western and she's a young woman Tom has had a great deal of affection for. We also meet her father, Squire Weston, played by Hugh Griffith. Sophie has just returned from Paris where she's learned to be a lady, and Squire Western is basically a drunken woman chasing dude who's very much like Tom in some ways, except not as refined.
And he definitely likes Tom because he feels their kindred spirits in that way. They like to have fun, drink, carouse.
Yeah, I actually kind of like his character. I think he's kind of funny like throughout the whole film.
Here's the backstory to that. So it turns out Griffith wasn't just playing a drunk, he was drunk. So he struggled with alcoholism and was deep in a bender for this film. There's even the scene where he's riding this horse drunk and he pulls on the reins in a way that caused the horse to fall backwards on him. The cast thought he had been killed in that moment. And you can actually see this scene in the film. They kept it in the film. And you see the cast running towards him as it cuts away. Luckily, he was okay.
It's kind of amazing what the things actors can get away with, because like once they're on screen, you're like, all right, well, you're here and we got to get this done. We don't have any money.
Basically, they're like, well, we're not going to recast you at this point. This is a small budget indie film.
But if they would have, that would be irreverent.
Well, that would have been the end of the film. We would have never seen Tom Jones.
Is that such a bad thing?
I don't know.
So sometime later, Tom is at church and Molly arrives. And guess what? She's pregnant.
I love this service scene. Yeah. Do you remember this?
Yeah, like, it's good.
Tom Jones is standing at the front of church in his like assigned pew. Molly comes in. We can tell that she's pregnant. And he looks back at her. He does a double take and he sees it. And then he starts praying really hard and singing really loud. Like he's like, oh, crap. I thought that was good.
I did like the scene, actually. It's probably one of the scenes I like the most out of the film. And as a side note, there's this tiny little bit where Molly calls out someone's name and she's like, Goody Brown, I'm going to come and get you. I really love the name Goody Brown. and I'm definitely going to steal that for a future short story.
So just to fill you in on this, so after that service, the women of the area attack Molly for her sins, calling her a hussy. Like someone throws manure at her. They've just left church, and they're actually in the cemetery adjacent to the church, like walking home. She picks up like a femur and then attacks another lady. There's just like a femur laying on the ground. Like, I thought that was great. And then Tom comes in, basically stops this all from happening, and takes Molly away on his horse.
You know what I'm realizing is that we're talking about it, and theoretically this movie's funny, but it didn't come through.
No, well, it doesn't gel well. I watched it twice, but there's a director's cut. We'll talk about that in a minute, but the director's cut is much better. Just they've cut out some things. It's shorter and more condensed and more streamlined.
I think this is a recurring theme through the film is sort of hypocrisy, because they come right out of a church service and it's church is about forgiveness, and they're just like, get rid of this hussy.
Well, so this leads into the next scene, and I think this is a good example of that too. So Tom then goes to see Molly a few days later because he wants to own up to his mistake, and he basically barges into her room. And Molly yells at him saying, why hasn't she visited her? She's so lonely. She's suffering. People are harassing her. Before this, Tom's tutors, he's got two scholars. One seems to be more religious. One seems to be more scientific, trying to educate him. And, you know, they're always harassing him for doing things like this, going to see other ladies. He bumps into this curtain and it falls down. And one of his tutors is standing naked, dressed up in like ladies' clothing behind the curtain. And we discover that that tutor is actually probably the real father of this child. So there's that level of hypocrisy as well.
And he never gets in trouble, the tutor.
Yeah, we just don't see it in the movie anyway, because they condensed a 1,000-page book.
And Molly disappears after this?
He has another romp with her.
Oh, yeah, he does. Yeah, she's insatiable.
He's incorrigible. Yeah. So.
So in the next scene, Squire Wesson organizes a hunt, and they're looking for a stag, I'm assuming. We are treated to a long, tedious scene of people getting drunk and running through the woods. And at the end of the hunt, Sophie's horse is spooked and it runs off with Sophie still on it. Tom gives chase, stopping Sophie's horse, but in the process, he managed to break his arm.
Two things about this scene. One, they wanted the dogs to tear apart a carcass that they had purchased, but the local hunters were really annoyed with the filming in the area. So the hunters broke into the dog pound the night before and fed the dogs a lot. So they had to refilm that scene later.
And maybe I didn't do a great job describing it now that I'm thinking about it. It's like shaky cam, fast cuts. It's a lot.
Yeah, it was filmed on the back of a car, actually. So they were like driving this car along this road as these horses are running. It's a long scene. There's a lot of textures in the scene, which I thought were really interesting. So they used a lot of filters and on the cameras there to like soften things, but they took those off in the scene to show you like all the gritty realism of this horse getting spurred and it bleeding because the rider's hitting it so hard, and then the dogs kind of tearing into the deer at the end of it. I think another story about this scene is that, again, Griffith was drunk throughout this film. They filmed it over several days, this scene. He was drunkenly hitting all the other riders with his riding crop as he was going about. So the director actually did something to the riding crop so it wouldn't hit as hard. Griffith actually discovered this and undid it. He ended up hitting Tom Jones, played by Albert Finney, in the face during the sequence, drawing some blood. In character, Finney turned to Griffith and said, I can't abide to be whipped, Squire, and then punched him square in the face. And then each stalked off the set, swearing never to work with the other person again.
Well, they did. They worked together.
Well, you know, I guess if one of them's really drunk, he might not even have remembered doing it. So,
you know what the equivalent of this in like frat parties is?
No.
Taking your beer and hitting the top of someone else's beer.
Oh. So, is getting whipped in the face the same as that?
They're both, maybe. So after Tom is hurt, he's on the mend and he spends more time with Sophie. And they have a lot of fun, and we see that their relationship is blossoming.
In a montage.
I think my favorite part of this montage is when Tom acts like a knight riding a donkey, and he's just like riding around. I thought that was really cute. Probably the only like cute thing I think of in the entire film.
So while Tom is recovering at Sophie's, Squire Allworthy and his sister Bridget are in a carriage accident. So that's basically Tom's adopted parents. Bridget is killed, and Squire Allworthy is gravely injured. Bleeful, Bridget's son, intercepts a letter that she wants delivered to her brother in the event of her death. So Squire Allworthy is supposed to get this note, kind of her will. And it seems like Bleeful will screw Tom out of his inheritance as a result. but Allworthy ultimately pulls through.
And Tom ends up getting super drunk in celebration, and he goes wandering off into the woods singing his little song about wine, and he runs into who?
Molly.
Yeah.
To those who find our hero's behavior startling, the answer is simple. Tom had always thought that any woman was better than none, while Molly never felt that one man was quite as good as two.
While he is mid-action, Blifil catches him and tells Allworthy. Tom ends up being tossed out of the manor for acting ungentlemanly, but given 500 pounds to take with him. And I have no idea how much 500 pounds is, but apparently it's a lot.
That would have been a lot at the time. And then just one other note here, too. When Allworthy pulls through, Tom starts getting drunk to celebrate. Blifil's like, you should knock this off. My mother is dead, you jackass. And he's like, well, you should also celebrate because Allworthy is alive. And Blifil definitely comes through that he just wants the inheritance. Tom basically chucks him up on a bench and thrashes him. And that's when he gets tossed out too. So this is another reason Blifil is pissed off at him.
I just want to make a comment here. You know, Molly really likes hanging out in the woods.
Like, she's a wood nymph.
Yeah, she's like, oh, there's someone walking by. Nice.
She's like, hey, Tom, you want to roll in the ferns?
They were ferns.
They always are. I don't know why.
So Sophie's aunt arrives from London and says that it's obvious that Sophie is in love with the boy from the Allworthy Manor. The aunt says she'll arrange for them to be married. Sophie is extremely excited. The twist is, instead of Tom, the aunt is trying to arrange a marriage with Blifil.
Blifil.
Yeah. That guy's terrible, man.
Mm-hmm.
Sophie tells her dad that she's in love with Tom, and her dad freaks out, which is actually kind of funny considering that he is a huge philanderer. And he's like, this is not going to happen. You're going to marry Blifil.
I mean, he really did like Tom up until that point because they acted so similarly. But then he realizes that he's like, I can't let my daughter be with a man like that.
I taught you who you should like. Oh, no. I learned it from
it's
you,
like,
Dad.
Damn it. Women apparently fall in love with someone who's like their dad. So here we go. So Tom has been kicked out of the manor. He's on his own. He's basically sucked at being out in the real world and gets in a fight with a soldier. They get into a verbal argument, and then the soldier throws a vase at him, hits Tom square in the face, puts him in a coma. The soldier is accused of murder, but is freed from jail by a prostitute, and then they escape the gallows off into the woods together. When Tom awakes, all his money is gone. And then as he's wandering the road, he comes across the soldier who tried to kill him and the prostitute who rescued the soldier, and the soldier's trying to kill the prostitute. So obviously this guy's a great person. Tom saves this woman, who's Mrs. Waters, and chases off the soldier. Tom and Mrs. Waters then go off to town together. I actually like this scene as they're traveling on the road. Mrs. Waters' shirt basically has been torn off of her, so she's like holding up the front of it over her breasts, and Tom keeps looking back at her, and then they start quoting something from like Eurycides looking back at hell. He didn't want to be tempted by the fires. So he keeps like looking back at her, and then he puts his hat over the camera. It implies that they go do it.
So what I wanted to mention in this scene is that Tom is a moron. When he rushes in to save this woman, which is great, the first thing he does is chuck his staff walking stick at the dude. All right, I'm completely defenseless, and this other guy has a sword. It's like, what are you doing, you moron?
Well, he wins, so that'll show you, Dave. Yeah.
Next time I see something, and whatever I have, I'm just going to throw it.
So then Mrs. Waters and Tom go to a hotel, and then they proceed to have this raunchy dinner. So Dave, let's describe this scene. So we have Tom on one side of this table, Mrs. Waters on the other. They're looking at each other and stuffing their face. What are they doing? What are they eating?
They start off with, I think, some seafood, some like lobster, and they're like sucking at it, and then they're like pulling meat apart, and every food they're eating is building upon the other one, becoming more overt,
salacious. Yeah.
Until finally Miss Waters essentially has a pear, and she just like rips into this thing, and juices are running down her face and over her bosoms. A lot of people really like this scene. It's probably one of the more famous food eating scenes. I personally thought it was disgusting.
So it's supposed to be a metaphor for ravenous desire.
I got it. I just didn't like it.
Yeah, and as a side note, so the scene took 3 hours to film, and eating all those things, and I quote, had a physical effect on the actors that lasted for days.
You want to guess what that was?
Probably a lot of farting.
That's the worst. I would never want to act an actor who has to eat something.
Like a lot of it, as they filmed it over and over. So then Sophie heads out on the road on her own. So she decides to run away from her father. She runs into her cousin, Mrs. Fitzpatrick, who is also running away from her husband. So Sophie and Mrs. Fitzpatrick abscond to London together. The cousin's husband Fitzpatrick, obviously Mrs. Fitzpatrick is married to Fitzpatrick, arrives at the same hotel that Tom is at with Mrs. Waters. He asks the attendant if a man and a woman have shown up together, and he's told yes. So Fitzpatrick is thinking that his wife is cheating on him and has run away with another man. He kicks the door in and finds Tom on top of another woman. Fitzpatrick, thinking it's his wife, starts a fight, and a few minutes later, he realizes it's a mistake. At this point, Mrs. Fitzpatrick and Sophie have arrived at the hotel and heard Fitzpatrick shouting and running around. There's some comments about how Tom was raping someone. Sophie passes out, but her and Mrs. Fitzpatrick then continue on their way to stay with their friend in London. So there's all these miscues and things like that. And then after Tom runs out too, because he's chased out, Fitzpatrick then sleeps with Mrs. Waters also.
What a hypocrite.
What a hypocrite. So then the lady that Sophie and Mrs. Fitzpatrick are staying with is Lady Belliton. And she is an older lady, more experienced, is into free love, one might say. So Lady Belliton hears Sophie's plight after she arrives and says she will help. Sophie and Tom talk to each other about their issues. And she ends up sleeping with Tom. And then Tom becomes her kept man. So Tom has no money. She's setting him up, but also sleeping with him.
What I like about this film is that there are a lot of mature women hooking up with Tom.
Tom does not care. He will sleep with anybody.
Yeah, I like exploring that side of sexuality, or just continuing to explore sexuality. Sexuality doesn't stop when you're 21.
Or 40, because Lady Billiton's like only like 40.
So. Oh, that's all. She has straight black, straight like silver hair.
It's powdered.
Never mind then.
So Tom discovers that Sophie has come looking for him in London. So he tries to get out of this relationship he is in with Lady Belliton. He proposes marriage to her. Lady Belliton thinks Tom is very serious and calls off the relationship and then decides to show Sophie the marriage proposal.
That's the worst. Like, you can't get a break.
Nope. So Sophie's like really pissed at Tom, and Tom tries to visit her, who then tells him to leave. And don't forget that Mrs. Fitzpatrick is also staying in the same place. So on his way out the door, Tom runs into Fitzpatrick and they have a little exchange. Tom's like, oh, I saw you at the hotel the other day. How are you doing? Now Fitzpatrick definitely thinks Tom is sleeping with his wife, and they draw swords and duel. Tom seriously injures Fitzpatrick in this incident. Bleefel's agents are actually tailing Tom this entire time. They tell the local constable that Tom tried to rob Fitzpatrick, and then Tom is sentenced to hang.
This is a perfect example of fake news. I kind of got incredulous when the two guys ran up and were like, oh yeah, Tom was totally trying to rob Fitzpatrick, despite there being like 30 other people there that saw what happened.
Oh, in this scene, Tom snorts something and then has a weird voice and sneezes a couple of times. I've been trying to figure out what the hell he was snorting. Do you have any idea?
I just assumed it was cocaine.
Were they doing cocaine in 17... They probably were.
When weren't they?
I don't know.
That's what I assumed. I just assumed he was like, yeah, I just need a little bit of pick me up.
Yeah. All right. Alworthy learns that the letter Bleefel has intercepted and takes it back. Alworthy also learns that Tom is set to hang and heads out to save him. On his way to get Tom, he runs into Mrs. Waters, who actually turns out to be Jenny Jones, Tom's mother, who Tom has slept with. Dave, what are you thinking at this point?
I was like, are they really going to do this? This movie has been so all over the place at this point, so maybe they will. And they had me going until Ginny looks at the screen and kind of just smirks and is like, maybe it's happening.
She's like, I did sleep with Tom Jones. So then we find out that in that letter that Bridget sent to Alworthy, it was actually her son. We don't know who the father is, and he's Bliffle's half-brother. And Jenny Jones was basically given money and supported to leave the baby on Alworthy's bed so that he would raise it as one of the family members. And he is. In a way, Tom is no longer this illegitimate child who does not stand to inherit anything. Now he stands to inherit half of Alworthy's stuff and half of his mother's stuff as well. But by the time Alworthy gets there, it is too late. Tom has been hung. But Squire Western has heard about this as well, heard that Tom is a legitimate heir to the Alworthy fortune. He shows up on his horse, chops Tom's rope in half, and rides away with him, giving him his blessing to marry Sophie. So then Tom and Sophie get together. End of story. Finally. That was like a very long 2-hour movie. It really, really felt very, very long. I watched Cleopatra and enjoyed like most of it. I could not get through this movie. It was so hard.
Yeah, it took me 3 tries. The first time I got right up to the first fight scene and then I turned it off, and then I watched like another 30 minutes and then I had to go back and start from the beginning because it had been too long.
So I do want to say I bought the Criterion Collection and it comes with the director's cut as well. And the director's cut is only 7 minutes shorter, but all of the scenes have like an extra 10 or 20 seconds on the end or beginning of them that is unnecessary. And the director cut all of that out and it was so much better.
I should have done that. Saved myself 7 minutes.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible what like good editing can do for a film. Richardson, the director, said that he always had wanted to cut these things, so kind of ran out of time and money. Richardson does not actually think this is one of his best films, nor is it deserving of the attention that it got.
I agree with him.
Yeah. So it's interesting to hear the director say that, just putting that out there.
One of the things I think that made this film feel really long was just the plot was incredibly convoluted. It did feel episodic, which I guess it makes sense because it was based on the books.
I mean, I think that's part of the problem is they condensed so much into a very short film, and there's no way they could cover everything. Tom Jones might be better served as like a masterpiece theater adaptation of like 18 one-hour episodes, trying to get everything in. I think this was considered kind of the great English novel of its time. It's like a coming-of-age story, person finding their way in the world, and then living in all these different worlds.
So the question I have is, what was Tom's story arc?
I think the book itself, I think the author even states this at the beginning, is it's a look at humanity or something like that. I forget what the author says, but Tom is basically this flawed person. He's a good person, but he's not necessarily good at doing the right thing. The story is about this imperfection and hypocrisy and navigating your way through the human world. What is Tom's story arc? So he's rags to riches is the story.
I guess what I meant by that is like, I don't feel like he overcame anything himself.
Well, he got tossed out and then kind of made his way in the world, sort of.
Sort of, yeah.
And then made his way back to his true love, even though he's not good at being faithful, or he's not even intentionally like trying to go out of his way to like sleep with other women. It just happens to him. I know that sounds lame. You don't just like fall into having sex with a lady, I guess. You trip and suddenly you're doing it. But Tom actually pretty much does that.
That's right. He's in the woods. Oh, look, it's another woman.
Oops, I'm in the ferns again.
All right, so we've already started talking about this. Let's move into discussion. So what are the themes, you think?
Well, definitely that flawed aspect. And I think the other thing that's important, again, we touched on this, is that Tom lives in all these worlds. So it's kind of this radical idea that, you know, class can be transcended, or does it need to exist? And I know that doesn't always come through in the film so much because we live in such a different time. Don't think about that as much. This was a huge deal at the time.
I think this ties back to what you said earlier, that we might not be the right audience for this. We might totally get it because we don't live in a class system as rigid as I'm assuming what the UK's was at one point.
Right. So the next time you and I join our Victorian steampunk club meetings, we can ask questions about this.
Where would the monkey, mechanical monkey, be on the hierarchy?
Below Lord Steamcloud. The constable is here.
That's a really good point. And probably when that was better known about in the 60s.
I doubt it. Not in America.
I saw a lot of duplicity between the sexes in which the men could do whatever they want and not really get in trouble. Partridge did get sent away and the women were in a lot of ways blamed, particularly Molly.
I think the hypocrisy thing is something that you touched on as well earlier. I think that's a big theme in the movie because you have his tutors yelling at him not to do things and they're doing those things. We have Squire Western liking Tom, but then not liking Tom when it turns out he likes his daughter, even though they're basically the same people and behave the same way. There's a lot of that in the film. And then Bleeful is like this upstanding character. He walks around like a pastor, it almost seems, you know, in a way, but he's really like a miserable jackass.
Wants to kill his brother.
Basically, and inherit everything. So it's like a false piety.
Yeah, that goes all the way through the film. That's a really good point. So what did you like about this?
I think there are some moments that are really funny in the film, and you really have to pay attention to the dialogue. So watching it a second time, I appreciated it more. But like as a whole, the story and acting, like it's not that great. So what did you like about the film?
I liked the actor who played Tom Jones. I think he was a fun character, actually. He's fun to watch. And like you, I appreciate this film a lot more than I like it. There are scenes that are okay. I really liked the beginning of the film. I thought it set it up to be like a good comedy. But overall, it just got bogged down in the middle and it was slow and I had a hard time paying attention. But when you watch it like individual scenes, the individual scenes aren't bad. It's just when you put them all together, for some reason, it's not, it doesn't live up to what it could be.
It's not really a coherent story. And Dave and I, we kind of gave you the plot. There are a few other things that happened in the movie that we just didn't touch on because it's so convoluted. It really is. It's a pain in the butt to summarize. And it's not that funny for a comedy either. That's like the real kicker. They describe it as a comedy. I would not put this in the comedy genre.
Or maybe we just don't get English comedy.
Dave, I don't mind Monty Python. This is shite. To borrow a word from the Queen's English.
Who's the guy who walks around Johnny English? Mr. Bean?
Oh.
I love that dude.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, there's certain British humor I appreciate, and this is not that. So why do you think this movie won, Dave?
Based off of everything you've talked about, it sounds like it was directed in a vastly different style than movies that had been directed previously. So it was something new and people hadn't seen it. And that's probably plays a significant role into why it won. Do you have a better idea?
No, I agree. I think it's this blending of genres. It's this art house new wave and a studio production, and it gives us something entirely unique as a result. So it definitely won for that technical achievement. And maybe that storytelling cinematography aspect that goes along with it. But I guess the storytelling aspect is to be stricken from that sentence. The storytelling was not good. It's a low budget film, and it feels that way. The one for its technical accomplishments.
But that doesn't mean it's the best movie of the year, because we clearly both liked a different movie more, I think.
Yes, I liked Cleopatra better. I saw How the West Was Won. That was honestly a little boring. How the West Was Won had like four different directors and they each filmed like a section of it. It's kind of disjointed. But Cleopatra, I thought was a lot of fun. Despite being 4 hours long, it felt like it took less time to watch than Tom Jones.
I also really liked Cleopatra. And what I was thinking about this was that we might like it because we don't see movies like that anymore. It's a rare treat to get a super long, lush film.
It's the golden age of Hollywood with giant sets and huge casts and real everything, real horses, real actors, real sound stages, props are not green screened. It's pretty ridiculous in its scale.
To your comment saying that Cleopatra flies by, I was 2 hours in before I knew it. And I was like, oh, I've already watched basically all of the same amount of time that I would have taken to watch Tom Jones. I didn't even notice it.
Yep. So, winner or wiener?
This is an absolute wiener. Do not bother watching this film. You can appreciate it from afar. You can go on YouTube, just watch a couple clips. You'll be fine. Just skip it.
I agree that it is a wiener. I think the cinematography that we talked about, this blending of new wave studio production, is really interesting. I watched the cinematographer talk about what he was trying to do, and I thought that was actually really, really fascinating. However, the plot and the way it was pulled together was garbage. So it's a wiener. Don't need to watch this one.
Yeah, would you tell people to watch Cleopatra instead?
I would. I actually really liked Cleopatra. It is 4 hours long. There's an intermission. Take it.
This is two night affair. First night, second night.
Yeah, it's 4 hours. Like, give yourself a break. Yeah. But you'll probably like all of it. It's just interesting.
Yeah, I can tell you with Cleopatra, the stuff with Julius Caesar is awesome.
It was just fun.
So do you have any feedback or have you heard feedback?
Well, I think I heard from you that someone says they want to hear our opinions earlier in our discussion, but I also heard from someone else saying that they appreciate how we go into much detail in all the films because they're not going to watch many of them. So I think the fine balance has maybe been struck because we haven't heard anything from anybody else.
So like the news media, everyone hates us. So that's great.
Cool.
I haven't heard much of a feedback. I did have an Instagram follower tell us they loved our name, thought it was hilarious. Thank you. I appreciate that. Not a lot going on.
All right. So what's up next?
Around the World in 80 Days won the ballot. Very, very slight. They won by 2 votes. That is basically Jules Verne's classic about a guy who has to get around the world in a hot air balloon in 80 days. Don't confuse this with the 2000s era film with starring Jackie Chan. This is the...
And Luke Wilson. Or is it Owen Wilson?
I think they're both in it.
The Wilsons.
Starring the Wilsons. So we're going to watch the older one. Remember, this is supposed to be one of the worst Best Picture winners. So
worse than this one?
It's supposed to be bottom three.
Can't wait.
Yeah. But after this, though, we're done with the bottom three.
I hope there's a Criterion Collection so I can really get my teeth into it.
So I haven't seen it, and I haven't even seen the remake. I just know there's a hot air balloon. That's what I got.
Again, like I felt like I watched this movie when I was... like 8 years old and really liked it. So I'm going to give it a shot again.
Okay. So if you like our podcast, we have a favor to ask. Please rate us wherever you get it. You can also follow us on all the social media, Facebook, Instagram, you name it, we're there. You can send us an email at john@awardwinners.com or david@awardwinners.com.
You can also visit our website, download our stuff, and don't forget about our Titan-level patrons. If you would like to give us some money, I'm looking at you, Senior Mike, who keeps asking us to do the Titanic episode. For $1,000, we will do the Titanic episode.
As soon as we can.
As soon as we can. 2 weeks. It might be 2 weeks. That's on Patreon. You can look us up on Patreon.
And I have a quick update. We are still at 13 reviews. Remember, when we get to 50 reviews on iTunes, it does unlock Titanic. So the options are three things here. Either pay the $1,000, get 50 reviews on iTunes, or wait to the very last episode, which is episode 90 or 91 at this point.
It's like 94. I think the other thing of note, Dave, how are we ranked?
We were ranked number one on Ranker's best movie podcasts. So thank you everyone who got online and voted for that.
Yeah, we appreciate that. I think Dave and I were very surprised to see that. And we may not still be there because we haven't looked in a while.
We were there on Wednesday.
Yeah. But I actually think some of those podcasts listed on there are really great. I added Faculty of Horror, which don't upvote them too much because we still want to be number one. But they are a very good podcast about horror films. Check them out. Dave, do you have any other shout outs to any of those, the people on that list that you feel are worthy of people listening to them?
I do. The number two is people I went to college with for my master's degree. We dethroned them. Hey everyone, it's David here with a quick editor's note. We lost about a minute of material at the very end of the podcast. We were going to say is you should follow Faculty of Horror and Movie Films and Flicks. Those are both great podcasts that we listen to. Other than that, hope you had a great time, and we'll see you next time for Around the World in 80 Days. It's not unusual to see me cry. I wanna die. It's not unusual to go out at any time. But when I see you out and about, it's such a crime. If you should ever wanna be loved by anyone, it's not unusual. It happens every day. No matter what you say, you'll find it happens all the time. Love will never do what you want to do.